From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, getting to know the European Union, France, and Germany.
None of our countries, be it France, be it Germany, none of us alone is strong enough to defend our values and our interests in the future.
The Europe that we have built on in the first stage was a Europe definitely tailor-made for a limited number of countries. And as we went on, growing up to 27, and once again maybe more in the future, we really have to change not only the institution, but certainly the way and the method of work that we have together.
Getting to know the European Union, France, and Germany tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news. Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Getting to Know the European Union, France, and Germany. Speaking will be Pierre Bimon, French ambassador to the United States, and Klaus Chariot, German ambassador to the United States. Moderating tonight's discussion is Alan Berger, senior editorial writer for the Boston Globe. We begin with an introduction by Ambassador Charles Dunbar, Professor of International Relations at Boston University.
On behalf of the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University, it's a pleasure for me to welcome you to tonight's discussion, which is entitled Getting to Know the European Union, France, and Germany. Our guests are Pierre Bimon, the Ambassador of France to the United States, and Klaus Chariot, Ambassador of Germany to Washington. Our discussion will be moderated by Alan Berger, who is a senior editorial writer for the Boston Globe. Tonight's discussion is part of a larger project, which is entitled Getting to Know the European Union, Member States in Focus. This project is generously funded by the European Commission delegation in Washington, and brings knowledge of the European Union, its politics, and institutions as they function on an individual country level to the attention of the broader public. Tonight, the focus is on France and Germany, both, of course, founding members of the European Union and its predecessor institutions. I'll now just read both brief biographic sketches before asking Ambassador Bimon to begin the discussion. Pierre Bimon was promoted Ambassador of France to the United States by President Nicolas Sarkozy on August 1st, 2007. Mr. Bimon joined the Foreign Service of his country in 1977 and was posted in London from 1978 to 1981. He spent the next 4 years with the Press and Information Office at the Quai d'Orsay. From 1985 to 86, he was seconded to the Institute for East-West Security in New York. He then returned to Europe, and specifically to Brussels, where he held a variety of appointments, including Deputy Director General of the Cultural, Scientific, and Technical Relations Department in the EU from 1996 to 1997, and then Director of European Cooperation from 1997 to 1999. He was appointed Ambassador and Permanent Representative of France to the European Union from 1999 to 2002, and until August, he served, he was Chief of Staff for the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Klaus Chariot served as State Secretary in the German Federal Office in Berlin from November 2002 until March 2006, prior to becoming Germany's ambassador to the United States. He entered the German Foreign Service in 1976 and has held positions at the German Embassy in Quito and the German Permanent Mission to the United Nations. In Berlin, he served as Political Director and head of the Political Directorate General from 1999 to 2002, and head of the International Security and North American Directorate from 1998 to 1999. He was also head of the Defense and Security Policy from 1996 to 1997, and director of the Private Office of the NATO Secretary General in Brussels from 1993 to 1996. I do want to say that I teach a course in the practice and process of American foreign policy, and I have always said that there is no more fascinating and multifaceted city to serve in the world than Washington. There are so many things that these gentlemen need to keep track of, so many different people and institutions to know and understand that they are truly blessed. As is said about people who have a good job, I suspect each one of them wakes up in the morning and wonders how lucky they are to being paid for doing something that must be as interesting as they do. Ambassador Vimo, over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ambassador. I feel a bit frightened by what you just said about waking every morning with so many things to do. I don't know how Klaus lives that every day. I think the question that was asked to both of us was to see how our country, France, for what concerns me, how our country has viewed its experience of the European Union since the start. If we admit that Germany and France are our countries that are there from the beginning, which is the case, since the beginning of the European Union with the Treaty of Rome, I think, to speak on behalf of France, that what has quite struck me, and I suppose it has struck you also, is the real difference between, I would say, a first period going from 1958, the origins of the Treaty of Rome, up to 1992, when we had a referendum on the Treaty of Maastricht, which was considered by the French population and I think by the French political leaders as a period during which France more or less managed to defend its interest, to have a clear vision of what it wanted to do in Europe and to, by a way or another, manage to have this vision put on the table and being more or less shared by Germany and by the other European partners. And there is a second period starting after Maastricht, which is, I would say, a more gloomy period for France, a period of uncertainty, of interrogation, of perplexity about what was going on in Europe and about its future. And I think this is something that is very interesting. And, of course, this second period resulted in a new referendum that we had on the draft constitutional treaty. It took place in May 2005. And that referendum came out with a negative result, more than 55% of French public opinion voting against the treaty, which, in other words, was also, to some extent, voting against the present state of the European construction, because it was very much something of that sort. And for those of the of us, because I was among those who worked very hardly on the first referendum, the Maastricht referendum, where the yes won, but with a very small margin, 51 against 49, we all knew at that time that things were becoming much more difficult and that there was a growing uneasiness in our country about Europe. How do you explain this change? And I'll go briefly about two or three concrete observations in order not to be too long. I think if you look at the first period, it was a sort of miracle. It was a time during which we managed to have economic prosperity with this very interesting bargain that the two main countries did together, France managing to protect its agriculture and Germany getting an agreement on opening the frontiers, opening the markets for its industry. And this balance bargain went on rather well and was very helpful for both our countries and all our other partners, the six of us that were there at the beginning. It was also a time where the institutions were working rather well. France likes to say that because, in fact, those institutions were very much organized along what we liked in France, with heavy leadership, a lot of centralization to a large extent. So we thought that the institutions were more or less along the image of France, and we liked that period very much, of course. It was also a time when we thought that the membership was more or less all right, even if we went from 6 to 9 and then to 10, and I would say 12 in 1992. We had the impression that this was still a club more or less manageable, more or less acceptable to everybody. And if you look also at another item that became more and more important at that time, the monetary union, it was also a time when we slowly managed, mostly with Germany, to organize what was first called the monetary snake, then the European Monetary Union, that slowly emerged as helping us to get as stable monetary system as possible. So those were rather good times. We decided to be more ambitious. We went for the Maastricht Treaty. It was sort of the peak of what we thought could be done in Europe. And this is why, even if they started to have some misgivings about Europe inside France, Europe still seemed to be on course and on track. Afterwards, everything has changed, and for the French public opinion, it has appeared as Europe was not at all fitting anymore with what we thought were our interests, and was slowly getting out of hand for, I would say, France's influence. Look at the numbers, of course. We have gone from 12 to 15, and now we're 27, with more to come. And in France, one has to admit, in spite of what Ambassador Obama said, very rightly so, that we all know that enlargement has been a success, and for the countries that have come into Europe, it has brought them prosperity, stability. They've gone out of a terrible period of violence or of difficulty. The fact is that in France, enlargement hasn't been perceived as such. It has been perceived as a slowly evolution of the nature of what we were thinking of doing among Europeans, and of a system that is evolving to something quite different, whose nature we don't know exactly, we can't exactly detect, and whose future seems to us rather complicated. Institution, second point. Since Maastricht, we have gone through, in less than 10 years, or let's say in 10 years, we have gone through three different treaties, three different institutional reforms. That is clear evidence that we're still not very happy with the kind of institutional balance we have, and that there's a lot of more work to do. Economic side. We have gone through a period where instead of enjoying this monetary stability that we have, we have got the impression that Brussels, the Commission, our partners, were more and more on our back, you know, trying to dictate to France what it should do, getting rid of its imbalance in public finances, trying to put pressure on the economic policy that we're going through. And this has been perceived as a sort of intrusion in our political life, in our political decisions, economic decisions, that has been looked at and perceived with more and more uneasiness, if not to say anger and even refusal. So you come out in the end with 55% of French people voting against the referendum, and you find yourself caught in great difficulties, as we have been going through the last 2 years. How do you explain this present situation and this change of mood that has been so surprising in France to some extent, even if it has grown up slowly and has been growing on time and time again? I suppose for two or three reasons. There may be much more, but I'll just give two or three. The first one, I think, is enlargement, because, as I was saying previously, the Europe that we have built on it in the first stage was a Europe definitely tailor-made for a limited number of countries. And as we went on, growing up to 27, and once again maybe more in the future, we really have to change not only the institution, but certainly the way and the method of work that we have together. Never forget that in Brussels, you have heard a lot about that, we were used to work in small groups. The meeting of permanent representative is a sort of club. During a long time, we were 6, 9, 10, 12, not more. Now, when you are 27 around the table, it becomes a very difficult meeting to manage on the everyday work. And this has totally changed the spirit of what we were doing in Brussels. I'm not complaining about that. It's a fact, and it's a good fact to a large extent, because once again, I think enlargement was a success and is still a success. But we haven't, I would say, sized the reality of this new balance of power that we have in Brussels, and certainly the French population has felt that this was something getting out of hand and that we were not really trying to find the right solution to this new situation. But above enlargement, and I think this is very important, one of the other reasons why France was not easy and was not happy with what was going on in Brussels is that I think it has to do with global economy. Europe was sold to the French people in 1992. This was one of the great slogans of the Maastricht referendum. Europe was sold to the French as a system that would protect the French people against global economy, the global economy being felt as a threat and as a danger for the French way of life, our economy, French cheese, wine, etc., you name it. Everything in the global economy was looked at and perceived in France as a danger. And the truth is that Europe was not made for that, and Europe didn't manage to protect the French population against a global economy. In fact, what Europe did was forcing us and putting pressure on France to adapt itself to the French, to the global economy. And this is what we did, because we have done that in air transports, in agriculture, in many other fields. There has been many success. But we have done it, I would say, in the worst possible way. We have done it under pressure, having the impression that we were forced on going along that path without wanting to do it. And a lot of criticism has grown up in France against Brussels, Brussels being seen and observed as a sort of avant-garde for the global economy. So this is where we are at the moment. And in fact, we are today at crossroads. I won't go into what we should look at the future. Maybe I'll go back to this when we debate the situation. But let me just tell you that what we feel now today in France, and what our new president, Nicolas Sarkozy, feels very much in France, is that if we want to go ahead with European construction, and there is no doubt that France wants to go ahead, if we want to get rid of the criticism and the, the bad feelings that have grown up in France against Europe, we have to look again at really what the vision and the kind of Europe we want to build in the future. And this is one of the reasons why Nicolas Sarkozy has asked for a wise men committee that could look at what should be Europe in the 20 to 30 years ahead, what kind of objective, what kind of goals do we have in the economic field, in the political field, in the foreign policy field, maybe what kind of institutional balance we should look at in the future, what kind of common policies we should try to get in agriculture, in transports, in regional policy, etc. We think that there's a lot of work on the table for all of us, and that we are only at the beginning, I would say, of a new phase in the European construction that has to adapt to the reality of today. To end my too long comments, and I apologize to you, I would say that to many extent, and this is what I find very interesting always in the European construction, is that what has happened during those 50 years between Europe and France was that it showed two things: a genuine problem that France had with Europe as it was building up and as France was trying to see the new kind of Europe it wants to build. But I suppose it showed a lot about France's own problem and the difficulties that France had to adapt itself to global economy that was considered by France, as I told you before, as something that was going against French interest. And I think in that sense, Brussels has given us a great service in forcing us to go ahead into that direction. There I am, Klaus. Sorry for being too long.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for inviting me again. I have good memories of last year when I was here together with my Polish friend and colleague, Janusz Reiter, and it's good that you have invited me again, so I'm not, I didn't do too many wrong things last year, and it's a particular pleasure to be here with Pierre, because as you can imagine, Germany and France do many things together, and also here in Washington and in the United States. So I'm pleased to be here together with you, Pierre, and thank you for inviting me. Let me just come back to what Pierre just called the vision, because I think if we want to understand not only Europe, but also why Europe on balance has been, looked at it with German eyes, a success, is the vision that was at the very beginning. The vision of men like Robert Schuman, like Jean Monnet, like Konrad Adenauer or de Gasperi, who said, we have to put an end to a phase in European history, which might have been very interesting, but which was also marked by numerous and endless wars. If we just take our two countries, between 1648 and 1945, between Germany and France, there were 23 wars. 23 wars in 300 years. And those people, they had the vision, they said, we have to end this. We have to put an end to this balance of power approach where always some countries balance out others. And we have a new vision. We do politics by integration. We do politics by sitting around the table and stopping the clock when we can't agree, but not beginning to shoot. And I think it has been a huge success. I think at the core of it, of course, was the reconciliation between our two countries, the Élysée Treaty of 1963, 6 years after the European model began. And I would say it does make a difference if you solve these problems by maybe very long nights, and I don't tell you you should envy any of us who has spent many nights there in Brussels. And for us, for Germany, we are together with China and Brazil, the country with the largest number of neighbors. We have 9 neighboring countries. And for us, of course, it is a huge benefit to have friendly and prosperous countries all around us, friends around us. To be surrounded by friends, of course, is extremely valuable. But I do not only want to look at the past, I would also try to look at the future. And there, I really must say, and this is from a German point of view, that none of our countries, be it France, be it Germany, none of us alone, I believe, is strong enough to defend our values and our interests in the future. I think if we want to have a say what should be decided in the great councils of the world, I think we have to pool our resources, we have to join forces, and we have to act together. And that, of course, was also one of the ideas in 1957, why we went together, because we, I think, have only a real say in world politics if we join forces. And we also can only defend our values, which are the values of the Enlightenment, which we all share, if we do work together. So I believe this is something which will also stay like that in the future. And I might add here, sometimes, or very often, or even I might say usually, it's not enough that Europe goes together. I think we also very often, in most cases, need the cooperation of the United States of America. And actually, we needed the cooperation also to put this European integration into practice. I think without the protection by NATO and without the protection by the United States, we would not have been able to do it in the middle of the Cold War. So I think both of these things go together, but I think we do need it to really defend our values and also our interests in the future. In addition to that, I would say it also makes much sense from an economic point of view, because we, for instance, Germany, we do 50% of our trade with our European partners. The second largest partner, by the way, is the United States. But the European Union, the countries of the European Union, are for us extremely important. We, as I said already, have, of course, an interest to have prosperous countries in our neighborhood. That makes for good relationship. We also think that to have a common currency, as we have now, the euro, is an advantage, not only because it really defines an identity of Europeans. I think it also makes economic sense, and I think it's quite symbolic that on one hand we have one side of the currency is the same in each country, and the other side is different in each of the 27 or right now it's only 30 countries who participate in each of the 13 countries. So it shows you that we have one common goal, one common aim, but we have also different national cultures, different languages, and all of that. Now, enlargement. I think, and I very much agree with the introduction, I believe it is really the most successful project of peaceful change ever. I think it was not preordained that all the 27 countries who belong now to the European Union would be democracies. If you look at the time between the First and the Second World War, the majority of those countries were not democracies. And I think if you even look at the Iberian Peninsula, there were very authoritarian regimes. It's just a little bit more than 30 years ago. And I think without the help of the European Union, you could not be sure that even Spain and Portugal would today be the democracies, the model democracies there are. And you could also say the same about Central and Eastern Europe. So I think it is not only the most successful project of peaceful change ever, I think it was really without alternative, because I think you can't really continue this totally artificial separation right through Europe in a poor East and a rich West. I think you can't sustain that in the long run. So I really believe there was no political alternative from a moral, but also from a political and also from an economic point of view to enlarging the European Union. But, and here I very much agree with you, Pierre, I think what we have to do and where we really have to do our homework now is deepening integration at the same time. Because, you see, Pierre, just like myself, we have sat numerous long hours in Brussels at the various committees and whatever, councils, whatever. You see, in the old days, there was a small round table and the person most distant was about this distance here, like the first row. And you could see the person in the eye, you could discuss, you could get a deal, you know, at the table. Nowadays, you have 27 people. The room is much, much bigger than this one. I would say two or three times as big. And actually, each person has a television screen because you don't even know who is talking. You know, you can't see the guy. You know, you look in the television. You see who it is, who is talking, but you don't see it in the room. And of course, you see, we had for six people or for 12 people, it was perfectly all right to have more or less usually a consensus rule that you do things by unanimity, but it doesn't work with 27. You have to find solutions by majority voting. You have to find new ways. You have to deepen integration, and you have to, before all, you have to enhance the capability to act of the European Union. And that's why we believe that the constitutional project was a good one. And that's why we in our presidency tried to save as much as we could from it and try to put together what we call a reform treaty. And I'm quite confident that it will be a success, that under the Portuguese presidency, this will be finally agreed. I think we have the agreement of the 27 heads of government, and I think we will get agreement to it. But I think it's absolutely necessary to get that, because without this deepening of the integration, I think one could in the end say that enlargement was enough. So to make it a real success, also in the long run, we need to do our homework and we need to enhance Europe's capability to act. One last word on globalization. I think Europe cannot protect us against globalization. I think we have here again, we have to do our homework. In no country it has been more painful than in Germany, because unification actually diverted our attention from away from reforming our economy and our institutions, and before all our economy, but also our budget and things like that. But we have to do it. But I think, again, we have to do it together. The European countries have to stick together. And in many cases, we will also have to do it together with the United States. We have to formulate common standards, common rules, and all of that. But I think also for that, the European a response is necessary, but it will not save us the difficult task of adapting to globalization. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask a few questions. Let me start by asking about Turkey, which is very much in the news, and this goes to the question of identity for the European Union and the question of enlargement. With the election of President Sarkozy, I think there's a coming together of the French and German positions to some extent. The French position, as I understand it, is for something other than full membership. I wonder if you could each explain your country's view of what kind of role Turkey may have, should have, and what the principles are on which you would base that position.
Difficult one to start. I think we always had the conviction in France that by a way or another we should have close links and a close partnership with Turkey. It started with General de Gaulle, who made some important statements when he went to Turkey several times. Suffice to look at a map to see where Turkey is. It's just there at the border of the European Union today, at the border in the neighborhood of Greece. It is a sort of country between the European Union and the Middle East. It is therefore very important for us to have a Turkey that must be stable, that must enjoy economic prosperity, social stability, and it must be a partner with whom we can work. Not one of the present members of the European Union would go against this conviction. The real problem is, having said that, what do we do? Do we have Turkey as a full member of the European Union? If so, it could become the most numerous country in Europe, because at the moment Turkey represents something like 70 or 80 million inhabitants, and it's growing because it has a birth rate very impressive. So it could become really the major country in Europe if it was a member of the European Union. Secondly, it is a country that has many differences with Europe with regard to the way religion is being ruled by the Turkish law. There is a lot of question with the different liberties around Turkey. So there is a lot of problems for Turkey to adapt itself to the present rule of law in the European Union. Turkey has said that it was ready to do so, that it needed time, and that during the negotiation, as we are negotiating at the present moment for full membership for Turkey, the Turkish leaders have the strong conviction that they can adapt to everything that exists in the European Union if we give them time to do so. French position at the moment is to say, let's go with the negotiation as they are going on, but let's wait for the moment to see what will be the outcome of that negotiation. Everybody knows that this negotiation will take many years, maybe something like 8 to 10 years, or maybe more, and that therefore we will know at the end where Turkey is, if it is possible for her to be a member or not. For the time being, the position of France is that we think Turkey cannot be a member. And as you know, it was decided in France a few years ago that every new membership in the future would have to be agreed by a referendum in France. And we know that with this arrangement, this constitutional arrangement, this disposition is in our constitution, there is, at least for the time being, very little doubt that the French people would vote against Turkey's membership. So this is where we are at the moment. We're taking, for once, a very pragmatic approach. This is not traditional with French, but this is the way we're doing with Turkey. We want to go ahead with most of the chapters that have to be looked at during these negotiations, And we want to see at the end of those negotiations where we stand with Turkey and to see what we do after that. If we go for a full membership, and then we will have to ask the French population whether it agrees or not, or do we go for something new that could be a sort of special relationship, special partnership that we would have with Turkey. We think that we have to look at this possibility and option of that kind, because we have other countries that are knocking at the door and with whom it is also going to be difficult to have them as full member inside the European Union. Think of Ukraine, think of Georgia, think of many other countries that want to come into the European Union and could bring with them major difficulties for Europe in the future. So this is the approach we're taking at the moment. We've had some difficulties with the authorities in Ankara because they were not happy with that position taken by France. We had a lot of discussions with them very recently. Our foreign minister was in Turkey 2 days ago. Our president had a meeting with the Turkish prime minister in New York about 10 days ago. And we are slowly, but I think surely, finding some sort of compromise to go along the path I was just explaining to you. Let's keep on track with the negotiations. Let's go on, and we will see in a few years' time where we are and what we do.
Germany and Turkey have always had very close and good relations. We actually believe that we have a very strong interest in reforms taking place in Turkey, and we have also an interest in having a very good relationship between Europe and Turkey, because Turkey is in a strategic position. It's a Muslim country, it's a secular Muslim country, and it's a Muslim country which is moving more and more towards full democracy and the rule of law. Now, the position towards Europe has to do with many facts. First of all, the European Union began talking with Turkey in 1963, and it has been a long-standing relationship. But I already told you that what keeps the European Union together is not a language. We actually have 23 official languages, 23 official languages. Any law passed in Brussels has to be translated in 23 different languages, because neither Pierre will get up French nor I will get up German as a language. So we have 23 of those. We have 27 cultures. So the only thing which binds us, the European Union, together is these values. It's the values of the Enlightenment, and is what we call the Copenhagen criteria, because in the early 90s, some people from all member states got together in Copenhagen and put together what these criteria are. You see, the criteria of the Enlightenment are democracy, freedom, human rights, rule of law, minority protection, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, all these things which you all know, because they're the same things as you have in your constitution. And now the treaty is very clear, or the situation is very clear. You can become a member of the European Union only if you are a European country, that means have territory in Europe. So Chile is out, Argentina is out, no chance. Even Mexico is out for us. And second, you have to fulfill the Copenhagen criteria, and not only in theory. You just can't write a nice constitution and say, now I follow all your beautiful recipes. You have to do it in practice. And that is the key test. The key test is if a country not only puts law on the book which say, okay, we have religious freedom and we have minority protection and we have rule of law, but in practice it has to have a functioning judicial system, and these concepts of the Enlightenment have to be put in practice, because it is the only thing which keeps us together, and therefore there can be no rebate. So for us, the answer is slightly different. For us, Germany, the answer is, if Turkey does fulfill all these things, Turkey can become a member. If she doesn't, she can't. There's no rebate. There is no saying Turkey is different than the other members. Turkey is in exactly the same position as other European countries if they fulfill those conditions. And, of course, if the other European countries agree, this is always a condition, then they can be a country. But I repeat, there is no rebate. You can't say, now, because it's Turkey, we make it easier for you, and you don't really have to implement, let's say, religious freedom in the eastern part of your country. So it is something, and even President Erdogan, he agreed when we talked about it, he agreed it will take at least 10 years. I think it is something which we should continue to press for. We need reformers in Turkey to do their homework. I'm very glad that the negotiations about acceptance go on, they continue, but they will last a long time. It will take a long time, it will take a lot of effort, but I think, and that is the decisive thing from our point of view, it depends on Turkey. If Turkey is in a position to make these reforms, to implement reforms, and also ready to give up the sovereignty, which we all have given up, then I think they have a chance.
I want to ask a question about something that is crucial to further integration of the European Union, which is the matter of a common unitary foreign policy, aside from the institutional questions. President Sarkozy is in Moscow, and he's made some fairly strong statements that he intends to ask President Putin to cooperate on sanctions on Iran. He wants strong sanctions so that there's no military option. And there are shades of difference in the European countries, including the ones that have been engaged in negotiations with Iran. I saw something in Der Spiegel that a German minister said that we Germans have, in fact, complied with the sanctions. We've made sacrifices. Both the French and the Americans don't really, and the Italians, that they go on using front companies and doing business with Iran. The question is, how practical is it that you can really have a common foreign policy when you still have the different national interests at play and then the different views of different governments?
You're right. It can be difficult, and we have seen in the past those all these efforts that we have been trying to succeed on and with foreign policy. Those efforts sometimes not being rewarded. I mean, Klaus, having been for a long time a political director, knows that better than anybody. But look at the same time how we've managed to work a small group of Europeans together on Kosovo, how we're trying to do it on Iran. You mustn't forget that the first countries that decided that something should be tried to get a solution on the question of nuclear issue in Iran were precisely Germany, Britain, and France. We started, the three of us, at the end of 2003, and it was only one or two years afterwards that the United States, Russia, and China were invited to come and to try with us to go along. So talking more precisely about Iran, I think we all agree on the need to use as much pressure with economic sanctions as possible. I don't think there is much doubt about that, and whatever one may say and whatever the difference of interest we may have, we all know that we have something like, nobody knows exactly, but let's say a few more months or a few more years before Iran, if nothing is done, will be very near the threshold of nuclear military capacity. And if we are there, then we'll be facing a very, very difficult decision to take, whether to accept Iran having the military capacity in the nuclear field or refusing it. And then how do we refuse Iran a capacity where, as it is quite near it? So the path of economic sanction is for the time being the only one we have. We have proposed dialogue to Tehran for now nearly 3 or 4 years, and they haven't In fact, they have refused. We have put many proposals on the table for nuclear cooperation, high technology cooperation, strategic dialogue with them on all the issues they would want to discuss, and we've never had any real answer to that. So we really have to put pressure on them with economic sanctions. Mind you, Russians are not saying that they don't want sanctions, and maybe they have accepted the first two series of sanctions we have taken, and they may be even ready to go for another round of sanctions. What they are asking for is for more time to see whether the Iranians are starting to understand the pressure being put on them and ready maybe to start in a sort of a dialogue, mostly with the the International Agency for Atomic Energy, and also with the efforts being made by Javier Solana to start real political negotiation on the question of the suspension of the enrichment process. So the Russians are not saying no. The Chinese are not saying we refuse a new round of sanctions. They're just asking for some time to see how things are going on. We think that we mustn't lose too much time, and that time is a very precious and scarce resource, and that we have to go as quickly as possible to put more pressure on Tehran. This is maybe where the difference lies. So we will see in the 2 or 3 months ahead how we manage to get an agreement on that. But just ending there and coming back to your question, I don't think there is a much difference of interest. And what have been said here and there by some economic leaders or some head of cooperation. The truth is that, take for instance France, and I think it's the same with Germany. Our bank, the French bank's exposure to Tehran has decreased in a tremendous way. More or less half of our investment in Iran have been stopped, and our trade is decreasing also on a very large scale. And I think that it's not even maybe necessary to ask our enterprises to stop making business with Iran. They're doing it on their own because they find it a very risky place to go at the time, for the time being.
I would like to answer your question actually with a clear no. I don't think Iran proves the point that there can't be a European foreign policy. I think exactly the opposite. I think it is the example of the last few years where three European countries, together then joined by Solana, really had an impact. When France, Germany, and Britain got together in the summer of 2002, and I was really in the room when this happened, I can tell you about the details. We got together and we said, the three of us, we said to have to act. And we also were convinced that we could only succeed if we go together. We at least had the feeling, and you shared that each of us alone, or even two of us, would have no impact. We had to go together. And so I think it proves the point that if you have three countries like that, and then joined by Solana, if they go together, we can have an impact. Because don't forget, for 2 years, it worked. For 2 years, Iran suspended all enrichment and all reprocessing. That means all those activities which can lead to nuclear weapons technology, so which made it possible that they could acquire a nuclear weapon capability. It did not work then after the summer of 2002 when Iran got a different government, actually, and Ahmadinejad made quite totally unacceptable utterances. And when they stopped their suspension, actually, we then were fortunate enough to also get the United States and Russia and China on board. And I think this, again, proves, and I think the Iranians were shocked when we in the IAEA Board of Governors, when we got India, when we got Brazil, when we got Argentina, South Africa, Indonesia, all voting against Iran. You see, you have to understand that in the non-aligned world, there basically is a lot of sympathy for the position of Iran because they say, why shouldn't we have nuclear weapons if others have? Why shouldn't we just do it? But we believe, and I think I know that we are joined by all our friends, we believe it would be a disaster if Iran would have a nuclear weapon, and that's why we insisted so much. But I think it's basically quite a success what we did achieve, because you see, as I said, there is a lot of sympathy for the basic position of Iran that nuclear weapons should be something for everybody, not just for 5 countries or 8 countries. And so I think they were quite impressed when we got all the other non-aligned countries to vote with us. And therefore, I believe that the 2 latest resolutions in the UN Security Council, 1737 and 1747, were a huge success, because not only Russia and China and, of course, the United States voted with us, but everybody. It was by consensus. And September 28, we actually got the Russian, the Chinese foreign minister to agree with the 4 of us that they would continue on this path in the Security Council. They, of course, also thought it would be good if Solana could continue his talks with El-Baradei. But this path to more sanctions in the Security Council is agreed. And I would really say that so far we have been not unsuccessful. I think if we really want to impress the leadership in Iran, and it's not Ahmadinejad who calls the shots, it's the religious leader. And if we really want to impress him, we can only impress him by being united. And I think so far, in the last few years, we have done quite a good job. And so I would say it proves exactly the opposite. It proves the point that if we act together, we can achieve something.
Well, I want to thank both ambassadors and a very attentive audience. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Getting to Know the European Union, France, and Germany. Our speakers were Pierre Bimon, French ambassador to the United States, and Klaus Chariot, German ambassador to the United States. Moderating tonight's discussion was Alan Berger, senior editorial writer for the Boston Globe. We began with an introduction by Ambassador Charles Dunbar, professor of international relations at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Mike Toda, with help from Matt Sloan. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.